The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Have the changes in the banking industry affected you? With the looming possibility that your local bank branch might disappear and more web, mobile, and social technologies, what will the changes mean for you and your business? Welcome to Breaking Banks with your host, Brett King. The possibility that banking is no longer a place you go, but just something that you do, has become very real. Now, here is Brett King.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. We had a very interesting discussion last week on social media. We had two great guests join us. We had Frank Eliasson from Citibank and Simone all the way from New Zealand very early in the morning there. And this was actually it's an interesting way to sort of segue into the show this week, because we talked a lot about how people are using social media to really communicate with banks and communicate with each other in these different relationships that have been created or through these communities. So it's a very interesting field to look at, but of course there's a lot of new technologies that have come into play in the last few years that have significantly changed our behavior. And not least amongst them is the smartphone. If you've been watching the news, you probably, if you're interested in tech and you're interested in these new technologies and changing behavioral dynamics, then you probably would have seen Mary Meeker's report. It gets a lot of press around this time of year when it comes out. All things digital as well. And it was very interesting to hear her or get into the detail around this changing dynamic in terms of how people are using smartphones. Of course, the big number was that there's been a 50% increase in smartphone adoption just in the last 12 months. So from 1 billion people on the planet with smartphones now to 1.5 billion people on the planet. Some of the other aspects of this data that's coming out right now, of course, is that tablet growth is happening at 2 to 3 times the growth of smartphones. So our interaction with technology is actually speeding up. Now, when new technologies come out like a smartphone or a tablet, or let's say Facebook, when this new technology first appears in the market, a lot of people sort of say, oh yeah, well, it's cool, but I'm going to stick with my own phone right now, or I'm never going to use Facebook. And suddenly, you have a situation where in the space of just a couple of years, these new technologies are dominating the landscape. And this changes people's day-to-day behavior. So today, instead of having a landline in the United States, most people, or in many countries in the world, most people are opting in just to have a mobile phone because they don't need a physical landline at home. And so now, this is a change in behavior. How does this change our interaction with retail stores? We've seen this shift in terms of the use of technologies like the iPad and the Kindle for purchasing books. And we've seen this dramatic shift in the way people read this content. We've seen that shift in iTunes, in the way people purchase music. So we really, the smartphone and the tablet have created this dynamic shift in purchasing and buying behavior. So the real question is that shift apparent in retail banking? And that's what we want to talk about today. How these technologies and this changing consumer behavior affecting the business of banking. And we have our first guest today is Ron Shevlin. Ron Shevlin is a leading researcher in the industry, works for a company, ITA Group. Ron, why don't you tell us about your role there and tell us a little bit about ITA to introduce yourself.
Sure, will do. Thanks, Brett, and thanks for having me on today. Appreciate it. I'm a senior analyst at ITA Group. We are a research and advisory firm based in Boston, focusing on the financial services industry. And my own research focuses on helping financial institutions improve the effectiveness and efficiency of their marketing efforts. So I look closely at FI's marketing strategies, online sales and marketing, marketing analytics, and heavy look at consumer behavior.
So this focus, you've at your core, you're a marketer, but the research you're looking at is really, would you classify this as around how financial institutions can engage with consumers or with their target market? Is that a sort of an accurate assessment?
Yeah, how they can engage, absolutely. How they can engage, how they can, but really about how they improve the quality of the relationships and also to acquire new customers and how they capitalize on the opportunities. And I think also very focused these days on how these emerging technologies will help financial institutions create new revenue streams, because that's one of the big challenges in the industry. If you look at many banks, their net interest income is very low as it comes from non-interest products. And so this is a big challenge, is where the revenue is going to get generated from. And I think there's a lot of opportunities to utilize these new technologies to create new services to help generate new revenue.
So one of the areas that I've been really interested in personally in the research you've done, of course, is this emerging Gen Y group, otherwise classified in various ways, millennials, digital natives, and so forth. And you've often talked about the fact that, you know, this group is obviously one of the fastest growing retail FI targets, because by the end of the decade, they'll represent almost half of the retail FI market. And you've talked about this concept of the debanked generation and this the Y Gens, how their behavior in respect to sort of a basic checking account is even changing. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. There's a lot of talk in the industry about the unbanked. And, you know, clearly that's an important segment to focus on. And yes, it's true that many consumers are underserved and under market and can't afford basic banking services even though they need them. But I think what's missing in a lot of the analysis is that there is a small but growing segment of consumers who are unbanked in the context that they don't have a checking account, but are hardly underserved or underprivileged consumers. A growing segment who are very highly educated, a higher than average percentage of them have college degrees or graduate degrees, are employed or certainly employable. If they're not employed, it's probably because they're still in school. And they are willingly opting out of the traditional banking system. You know, for 60, 70 years, consumers, as we became adults, the first thing we did was we graduated college, we threw away the checking account we had from the firm that ripped us off for the past 4 years, and then turned to another bank and opened up another checking account. For the first time in 60 years, the Gen Yers, the new emerging adults, don't automatically figure that they have to open up a checking account. They've done the math, they've done their homework, and they realize that there are alternatives to the checking account, that they can manage their accounts, their finances with a prepaid card and or a credit card, or find alternative ways to do it. So this is the important emerging debanked, I don't know if I'd call the whole generation debanked, but clearly there is a growing segment of consumers who are looking for alternatives. And this is important from a financial institution perspective, because traditionally young consumers have always represented a disproportionate percentage of the demand for checking accounts and credit cards and financial products. And if these consumers are not going to be turning to traditional banks for their basic services, that poses a big threat to the traditional banking system.
Yeah, of course, one of the very interesting elements of this is that, these are the digital generation, so they're very comfortable with things like social media and text messaging and now the over-the-top messaging, technology, Snapchat and so forth. So they're communicating like this all of the time, and their communication approach has changed. So it's only logical that things like how they send money would also change. So the tendency not to write checks, which is sort of a dominant behavioral shift between their generation and the earlier generations, it might be an explanation for why they don't like checking accounts. Would you think that is the check or the concept of a checking account in itself a problem for this demographic?
You and I might argue on this one, Brett, because I don't think it's about the check. The use of checks has been in decline for 10 years, well before Gen Yers started to come of age. If you look at even the Gen Xers' behaviors, they were really the first adopters of debit cards. So the use of checks has declined. I don't think it's so much about the physical form of payment as it is the payment for the account itself. Many young consumers, of course, struggle to manage their financial lives as they're just starting off in their careers and ramping up from an income perspective. And many of them overdraw on their accounts, overspend. It seems like I just completed some consumer research and found that about a quarter of Gen Yers found that one of the biggest challenges that they have to saving money on a monthly basis is that they are prone to making impulse purchases, which is, we've all done that when we were younger. So they struggle to kind of make those ends meet. And really what they've done is found that it's more economical and more advantageous to them to pay a prepaid card provider $5 a month versus a so-called free checking account, where if they overdraw twice in a particular year on that checking account, well, that's $70 in fees that pretty much wiped out the free checking account. So they realize, and they've modeled their behavior, they understand, you know, from the past what they've done. So it's, I don't think it's so much about a rejection of checks as it is a rejection of the traditional structure of a checking account, where banks have made their money mostly through penalties and fees versus providing value.
So, of course, you know, we've heard a lot about the Walmart factor in this, how Walmart's been huge in respect to the prepaid market. You know, it's ironic that people would feel comfortable going down and getting their primary bank account from a Walmart. But in respect to this pushback and this shift, do you think some of it's also a little bit of pushback against the traditional banking mechanism, some fallout from the global financial crisis?
Yeah, I think there's a huge aspect to that. I think if you, I don't really don't can't point to any specific research, but I think it's pretty clear to say that for a large extent, many financial institutions were blamed for the recession that occurred a few years ago. And there's probably lingering negative feelings. You know, the credit unions capitalized on this a couple years back. So there's certainly that aspect to it. But I will say this, Bert, I think that goes away. That ebbs and flows over time. You know, a couple years ago, it was BP who was the great villain of the U.S. because of what happened in the Gulf. Today, that's kind of gone away. They're not the villains. Then it became the banks were the villains for creating the economic problems. That goes away. What might not go away are the assumptions on the part of the emerging Gen Yers that there are alternatives to the traditional banking system that are perfectly acceptable. And what's interesting is
because it gives them the utility of banking without the hassles of the banking.
Yeah, you know, I've done consumer research for going on 15 years now. And 15 years ago, we asked consumers, you know, would you get a checking account from Microsoft or Sony? And that was 15 years ago. And consumers said, yes, we would. And that never happened. And then years later, would you get a checking account from Apple? Yes, we would. But that never really happened. Today's Gen Yers are not locked into the traditional banking system. They are open to all the alternatives and might not be the Google per se, but there are certainly opportunities, but not simply for firms who want to create me too checking accounts, but who want to create different types of accounts. And, you know, for lack of a better term, I've called them neo checking accounts I don't want to get too far away from the concept of checking, even though checking isn't the concept, but it's that day-to-day management account that enables them to have a mechanism by which they can spend their money, whether it's through a debit card or through a mobile payment mechanism. But it's an account that is structured differently in terms of, well, first of all, they tend to be mobile first in design. Not that they don't have branches because the companies that are providing them just don't find it economical to provide a branch structure, but there's still call center support. But it's a mobile first design. More importantly, though, to me, is that it's more of a value-centric type of approach where there's a lot of personal financial management or PFM-type capabilities that are built into the account, right, built into the infrastructure, you know, providing receipts immediately upon purchase, even if that purchase was made with a card, or alerts for spending that isn't, you know, somebody going, you know, into their PFM account at the end of the night, you know, to look at something, but right there at the point of purchase. And that's what's really different about these neo checking accounts is that they're built more on providing value on a day-to-day basis versus having an account to just store your money and use it to spend when you want to write a check or pay a bill.
So I really want to get into this element of and PFM, for those of you who aren't familiar, is personal financial management. So these tools like Mint that sort of slice and dice your monthly expenditure help you understand that. The real shift in this being this real-time aspect. But just quickly before the break, Ron, how quickly has smartphones and mobile banking, started to be a factor in day-to-day banking behavior for most retail consumers in the U.S.?
The simple answer to that is very fast. If you look at the rates of adoption of online banking when they first came onto the scene 15 years ago, and then online bill pay as that followed, the growth rates for that were much slower than the growth rates for smartphone adoption. The latest research that I just did, and literally got it back this week, says that about 60% of all consumers now have a smartphone. And of course, that percentage is way higher for Gen Yers than older generations. And the mobile banking numbers tend to increase as well. They actually are fairly low today in the 20s, but with the part of that is being slowed down by the supply side, where banks have been slow to provide those capabilities.
Right. Let's break at this point because we've got – I want to bring in Kevin Travis, who's the CEO of Novantas, just after the break. And then let's continue, because I think this smartphone discussion has a lot more legs in it for the rest of the show. So let's break at this point, Ron. And after the break, we'll be back with Kevin Travis, and we'll talk a little bit more about their research in respect to the – specifically the changing role of the branch. And then we'll get you back in the second half of the show, Ron, to talk more about the smartphones. Okay?
Sounds great. So
after the break, Kevin Travis, the CEO of Novantas, talking about the impact of this changing behavior on the traditional distribution model.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Is your business model robust enough? In today's ever-changing business environment, people are working to transform themselves, their futures, and their business. Tune in to Business Reinvention with your host, Nancy Lynn. To stay ahead of the game in business, you have to constantly reinvent yourself and your organization. With Nancy's experience and that of her guest experts, you'll learn from stories of inspiration, innovation, and forward thinking. Listen for Business Reinvention live every Monday at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
If you want to know about investing in emerging and frontier markets, or if you have experience in this field but still need to know more, tune in to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. Gavin explores news, current trends, and insights about both categories of investing. His guest experts, along with his own knowledge, will help you stay above the line when it comes to growth potential, whether in funds or equities. He will look at what to invest in and avoid. Tune in to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time, 6 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
You're back with Brett King, your host of Breaking Banks. We just heard from Ron Shevlin from IT, and now up is Kevin Travis, who my apologies, Kevin, you're not the CEO, you're actually the managing director, but welcome to Breaking Banks.
Thank you.
So, Novantas has done some great research, and it's very interesting that you've done this sort of progressive approach to this, where you've looked at this changing behavior in respect to the way people are buying in the branches and the way people are visiting branches, and particularly transactional activity. You guys called this pretty early, but tell us a little bit about what the numbers have shown in respect to this changing day-to-day banking behavior over the last 5 to 10 years, and what you guys have found through your research.
Yeah, absolutely, Brett. I think you know, a couple of really top-line takeaways. One is that there's been a pretty steady erosion of in-branch transactions of at least 3% a year for the last 7 or 8 years. We think that's accelerating closer to 5 to 7%. And as we see banks roll out new technology like image-enabled ATMs where you can just stick the check in the slot and a picture of it appears and you get immediate credit, that's going to accelerate the decline of in-branch day-to-day payments and service transactions. I think that if you think about compounding that out at 3% a year, you pretty quickly get to a 25 and 30% decline, which is one of the big dilemmas facing the banking industry today. Huge service capacity, a lot of cost, not nearly as much volume. How do we handle that? I think the other big takeaway that we've seen, and this was sort of our most recent insight, was the shopping and buying funnel for banking products has really fragmented and blown apart. At least two-thirds of folks are almost exclusively shopping for banking and FI products online. And over 75% at least do it as one of their options. They may go into a branch, but everybody is really shopping online. And that's fundamentally changing how people buy products. They used to walk into a branch, have a conversation with the folks at the branch, and then the bank had the opportunity to sell them a product. We think now customers are really looking online, picking bank products, and then the reason they end up in a branch, which they do still at a rate of around two-thirds, two of every three customers still says, I really want to do the first purchase in a branch, obviously leaving one-third to say they don't. But the reason they want to do that is there's still a psychological element of, I just want to kick the tires. The problem for banks is, if that's all they want to do is kick the tires and then they never want to come back, having 88,000 branches to do that one interaction is a very expensive way to sell to customers.
Right, and down from 100,000, so we're already seeing the impact of that. So, Brad Lima is on the Twitter stream, and he asks a question, which I think is very relevant to this. With changes to the revenue model and this consumer behavior and the things that you're talking about, the economics and the revenue model's obviously changing and shifting towards more people buying online. And we've seen this happen in all these other industries, Borders, Blockbuster, et cetera. So, what's banking going to look like in 10 years? Are we just going to be left with big banks who have enough cash and traction to keep their spaces and payment companies? That was his question. What's your answer to that?
That's a good question. I think clearly you're going to see, obviously the very biggest banks are the ones that have the wherewithal to invest in the kind of technology that's necessary to stay on top of where the customers are moving. And we certainly see the two or three really big national banks beginning to pull away in terms of attracting online customers, Bank of America, Chase and Wells and Citi. I think you'll see that happen and that consolidation will take place. I think the other interesting question will be, in this economic model, do we really need branch networks per se? And if so, what are we going to do in them? I think there's a persistent need for some form of face-to-face interaction with the bank. And for a large number of customers, it's more of a comfort factor that says money is not a book, right? We ask the question, we think books are going to move the way of books. I do think from a transaction perspective, we won't need branches, but banks are going to have to find ways to build the same kind of brand loyalty on a face-to-face basis, either through streaming video or through sales forces that they used to get by pulling people into their branches. And I think the banks that can invest in that kind of technology will be the ones we start to see pull out in front.
Great. So, tell me, in respect to some of the trends that you're seeing, what are the primary sort of engagements, the primary sort of products which are shifting away from the branch in the early spaces of this?
I think, what we call liability products, the deposit products, checking accounts are shifting the fastest, particularly because people have become more and more comfortable buying savings and checking and other deposit products online, and that's a category ING carved out, over 12 years ago. And certainly that's where the movement's been the fastest. Other types of fee-based transactions like making payments, anything to do with the payments wallet is shifting extremely rapidly. What's interesting is that mortgages and some of the consumer lending products, the first time out, and this is one of the interesting dilemmas we see with the Gen Yers. The one product we see Gen Yers still saying, gosh, I'm thinking about using a branch, is when they contemplate taking out their first mortgage. They seem to be more interested in going back to a bank branch, probably because there's more, they're a little concerned about the transaction. They want to go in and talk to somebody. But after that, second mortgages, refinance, all of that is moving rapidly out of the branch. And I think anything that can be done more easily and where the information is better provided directly to the consumer through an online or a mobile platform, consumers are opting into it because it provides a better experience.
Right. So, you know, there's a real art here, which is figuring out how to get rid of the friction and make engagement easier, because a lot of these processes have been built from the ground up around branch.
Right.
And the assumption that you're going to come in and you're going to fill out a piece of paper, and that's the way we're going to get you into this event, which is the mortgage application, and funnel you through our back end process. But, you know, as people's demands on these interactions become increasingly real time, you know, contextual through the smartphone and tablet and things like that, where I'm out, you know, looking at real estate on the weekend and I want to know whether this bank is going to lend me the money for this home. How is that also going to put further pressure on this engagement model, do you think? And is that going to provide some further emphasis for the emphasis on this shift?
Well, I think that's also, I think you're absolutely right. I think the ability to leverage information and provide real-time feedback to customers is clearly a level of expectation customers are developing from interacting with Amazon and with Google and with other companies, where there is a immediate, I won't call it gratification, but certainly immediate information provided back that says, here's, you ask a question, you get an answer. And banks have traditionally operated on the idea that, well, my cycle time is improving because I can deliver information over 3 days. And so clearly that's got to change. I think where it puts real pressure on banks is banks that have failed to invest in the kind of data and IT infrastructure that makes that kind of response possible are under real pressure right now, because the cost of moving to that infrastructure is pretty big when you think about the scale of a bank with 5 or 10 or 20 million customers. And I think that that's clearly, you're going to see continued divergence where the big national banks are able to deliver that. I actually think some of the smallest banks will also be able to deliver that, because they're going to be buying their services from big outsource providers who can deliver that same kind of technological heft. But the bank is really the core technology today. And we used to be the branch network. Well, the operation that matters now is that core technology platform, and that's going to be a real differentiator going forward.
Right, and so the distribution layer of how you reach customers, how you get those products to them, when they will interact with you to them, has to be, that's where the real innovation is happening.
Yeah.
And if you restrict them to just that one channel that you're comfortable with, then you're going to penalize yourself from a revenue and operations perspective.
Absolutely. And you also, you know, it's an interesting, you know, we have to wonder, we were talking about PayPal earlier. The thing we all have to remember is, even PayPal transactions pass through a bank. It's just that what happens is the economic relationship between the customer and the core provider alters. The bank gets disintermediated by PayPal. So PayPal still uses a bank somewhere to make the actual transfer of money between its different consumers, but it does it in bulk, and it is a much lower cost. And the real risk for banks is that there's going to be lots and lots of people who own the customer relationship, like a PayPal, sitting between them and the customer, and they lose that core relationship. And I think that's something everybody's very afraid of right now in the industry.
And this results in squeezing margins, but also, as you
yes.
say, disintermediation. But it's interesting you brought up PayPal, because if you take organizations like PayPal and more recently Square, one of the reasons I think they've been so successful in disrupting those traditional businesses, you know, PayPal in terms of person-to-person transfers and to some extent online payments, but and Square, you know, the merchant onboarding, is they got rid of the friction. You know, before before PayPal, you'd have to know the bank address, the ABA right. routing number, the sort code, all of these details to just send someone money electronically through the banking system. And PayPal said, well, let's just get rid of all that. If you know this person's email address or their mobile phone number, you're right. And Square, same thing. Let's get rid of all of this complex contracting to get a merchant account and just make it really simple. You can just download an app from online. How much of this shift is going to be down to the fact that it's actually getting rid of the friction? It's in a re-engineering of this distribution layer to make the financial services system much easier to engage with.
I think that there's two ways you can think about that. The way I think PayPal got rid of the friction was it made it into a self-service activity. In other words, if you know their email address, each individual customer provides all the information to PayPal, and then PayPal joins them up and passes the transaction and the information on the back end, making it easier for the customer. I think that banks have been really bad at that, and I think actually that's a place where bank technology innovation can come to the fore once banks understand that a customer really doesn't care whether it's a SWIFT payment or a wire transfer or an ACH or a card payment. To them, it's they're just paying their next-door neighbor, they're paying their rent. I think that there's an opportunity for banks to continue to do that, but it requires a significant mind shift. I think banks traditionally have had a supply-side mindset that said, what we do is complicated, and we need you to tell us everything up front so that we can make this payment as quickly as possible. I think increasingly, like you say, there's going to be an ongoing expectation because the experience the customers are having in other parts of the online world tell them that this should be easy, and when it becomes hard, right, they're going to opt out. They're already doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I absolutely agree. So listen, thank you very much for jumping in here, Kevin. I want to bring you back on the last part of the show and talk more about how the smartphone is impacting some of these behaviors and if you see a correlation in that with the research you've got. And thank you for joining us. After the break, we're going to invite Jerry Canning. Jerry's with Google Financial Services, and we're going to ask him about how Google's seeing people's behavior shift, particularly in the buying cycle. We'll be back right after the break.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Are you and your business well prepared? For what, you may ask? Well, what about workplace violence, cyber attacks, or general business disasters? Listen for Fear is Negotiable, Business Survival Skills 101 with your host, Pamela Hill. We'll bring you case studies of the businesses that don't prepare and the consequences that can happen. We'll also bring you best practice strategies that can help you keep your business running smoothly. Tune in to Fear is Negotiable, Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 a.m. Pacific on the Voice America Business Channel.
Dialogue is the single most powerful leadership tool we have to make a difference in the world. Leading Conversations with host Cheryl Esposito creates a place for that dialogue. Tune into the Voice America Business Channel every Friday as Cheryl hosts new conversations among leaders from around the world in business, government, art, economics, and social change. We'll explore big ideas and everyday actions and learn how their own leadership has led them to discover a newfound sense of possibility in the world. Leading Conversations with Cheryl Esposito, bringing big thinkers together in conversations that make a difference, right here on the Voice America Business Channel, every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
You're back with Breaking Banks, and I'm your host, Brett King. We've got a great show this week talking about customer behavior shift in the banking space. And we have on the line from the Google Financial Services team, Jerry Canning. Jerry, can you introduce yourself and tell us about your role at Google?
Sure, Brett. Thank you. I've enjoyed the show so far. Thanks for having me. I head up the teams at Google that cover the financial services category, specifically banking. So we have teams here in the U.S., across the country, that work with some of the top financial institutions to essentially act as their digital consultants and make sure they're making full use of digital and Google products across their business.
So tell me, in respect to, you know, tying in this, the massive amounts of data that you see as an organization, in respect to the way people engage, the way people talk about things, the way they buy, you know, what trends are you seeing from the data in respect to this changing engagement with financial institutions, or in respect to products that banks provide?
Well, obviously having access to data and having those insights can provide valuable tools and learning agendas for our partners. For example, when working with one of the biggest banks, we were able to demonstrate to them, just to emphasize the importance of digital, we were able to show them that roughly the same amount of foot traffic they get into their stores or into their banks on a daily basis is matched by the number of consumers who are searching for their brand online. So when they thought about digital in those terms, it only emphasized the importance of the platform and the fact that they need to spend, if not equal amounts of time, thinking about digital platform vis-a-vis their retail locations. Certainly, it emphasized the need to prioritize digital, perhaps even more than they had been to date.
So if you're listening in and you've got a call for any of the people that are on this week, feel free to dial in. Our dial-in number is 1-866-472-5790. I'd like to talk a bit more about, Jerry, this contextualization issue and, you know, the way mobile and, you know, the way we're moving around. One of the very interesting trends we've talked about previously is things like showrooming, where people walk into a Best Buy store or retailer and then pull out their phone and search for competitive products. But in respect to banking, you know, are you seeing some contextualization in respect to search? Are people searching for things like a car loan when they're out at a car dealership, or searching for information on a mortgage when they're actually out looking at homes? Are we seeing some of that data?
Yeah, I mean, there is there's some of that behavior as it ties to retail locations, but first and foremost, it's about really using mobile to as a de facto platform for connecting to data wherever and whenever you need those answers. We're seeing 25% of banking searches overall are coming via the mobile device, and 27% of the traffic overall that is coming in around banks is coming in via mobile. So the expectation is that there's an expectation for a seamless experience from desktop to mobile to tablet, and the consumer expects that from start to finish that they're going to be able to pick up a dialogue with a bank, and that should be just on a continuum as opposed to starting over each time. So that's one of the challenges that the banks are trying to step up to answering.
So if we take a new product like Google Glass, for example, and this, you know, the impact of this rich data overlay environment, how do you think advice and that selection process, maybe even, you know, what Ron was talking about earlier in the show, the personal financial management tools helping you understand a buying decision when you're in a specific location?
How imagine if Google Glass or a mobile phone, as you scan a barcode, could tell you if, you know, if something is out of your price range or you know, not necessarily a recommended buy? Those kinds of things, you know, a couple of years ago they felt like they were something out of Minority Report, but we're really getting very close to being at a point where we can provide that kind of we can help provide that kind of guidance if the consumer would opt to turn it on, per se.
So Kevin, early in the last segment, talked about the fact that from a mortgage purchase perspective, that YGENs, for that first mortgage, because it's a big emotional decision, they feel like they would like to go and speak to someone. But, you know, are you seeing in terms of buying behavior, this is considered probably one of the most complex products, a mortgage, that an individual consumer is going to have to buy. So, you know, are you seeing a shift in the way people make that decision in terms of a mortgage and who they go with as a result of their interactions with Google?
You know, I think Kevin nailed it, and that is probably the of across the banking space. That's the category that we've seen the least progress, and there still is some dependence or more dependence on the retail bank than in other cases where we've seen all on adoption. That being said, when I look at what a bank like a Chase is doing with their My New Home app. So the My New Home app provides really full functionality and really helps bridge that digital experience and allows the consumer to leverage the digital tools for all that they're worth. And that's sort of what I would highlight as a prime example of where digital can take you around mortgage and really to address consumer needs and make the entire process easier.
So take me through this process of a buying process, how someone might use mobile search and interact with Google in terms of choosing a product when they're out and about. You know, what sort of things could you could tell us from the data you're seeing?
Well, I mean, the value of mobile starts with access to information. So the idea of being able to use voice search as opposed to having to type and go back and leverage the tool for what it's worth is a starting point that makes it a lot easier. And when you think about a product like Glass and where we could go, to pick up on the theme you were on earlier, imagine if you are house hunting and the ability to create a tool or an app that would be able to pull up and recognize either through PFM or through other guidance that you gave could identify potential mortgage and how that could apply to the value of or the search process or the home buying process and what sort of limitations you could place. Those kinds of tools are well within grasp, and mobile technology really brings them to the fore in terms of connecting the consumer experience right back to information gathering, and that's really the role that Google plays.
Fantastic. So we're seeing people being a lot more empowered by this. You know, not so much self-service, but you know, recently Google announced their Gmail P2P capability. Where does this? And of course, you've got the Google Wallet. You know, do you see this as all part of a framework, including the search and the data picture that you guys are building up from a behavioral perspective? Is this part of an overall play to build really a banking foundation or a foundation for transacting and interacting with financial services through the Google layer?
You know, I think Google really looks at it as just part of a larger innovation shift. You know, the consumer, and it's all about empowering the consumer. We recognize that we're dealing with a consumer that in many cases has an always-on approach to the internet, and that access to data through mobile or through other devices is really what's spurring that. There was a recent study from Forrester that people said they were spending less time online, while the tracking study showed that they're actually spending more, and that's because the conclusion was that being online has become so natural to people that they no longer can perceive that their normal, what they think is as normal behavior, is being online, but that's part of being connected all the time. So as part of that shift, anything that when Google sees an opportunity to meet those rising consumer expectations, those are areas that we're beginning to continue to experiment in and helping connect the dots and facilitate and meet and help meet what consumers are looking for.
So Ron and I actually talked about the debank generation, the Y-gens, and of course the really interesting thing I think about that is that Y-gens or Gen Ys, digital natives, for them things like internet banking, social media, you know, using a smartphone, using an iPad, you know, soon it'll be Google Glass. These things are not new for them. They live in a world where technology is their expectation. But if you say to them, "I'm sorry, you can't do that. You have to come down a branch and sign a piece of paper," that for them is very new. That's unusual behavior. So we really have these two worlds fighting at the moment, one which is steeped in regulation and traditional approaches from a process and legacy technology perspective, and you know this consumer behavior which is pushing ahead this technology and contextualization very rapidly. So what's going to break? What's going to give? You know, are there going to be banks that just can't make this transition, do you think? And I know you're speaking to a lot of these banks, but from your experience speaking to them, is there just some banks that just aren't going to be able to make it in respect to this changing behavior?
You know, I would think there's the transition will continue, and you're very right. That behavior is very real. We also look outside of banking. We just look at, I don't know if you've heard the term cord cutters for individuals that realize they don't need to continue to pay their local cable because they can access their programming via mobile devices, for example. And I think it was 1% of the U.S. last year chose not to or did not renew their cable subscriptions. And then what's evolving past that is the cord nevers, those who aren't even signing up for cable out of school. And so it's all that same generation and an output of their behavior. And I think right. On the banking side, you know, when I talk across the board to the biggest banks and a lot of the mid and regional down the community banks, they all recognize this behavior, and it's trying to overcome legacy systems and just systemic challenges along with the regulatory limitations that really create hurdles for them. But that being said, I think we've seen a lot of fantastic innovation in banking. The fact that mobile check deposit is now...
Jerry, I'm going to jump in because we're running up to a break time. Yep. Let's get into that innovative approach, but let's sort of think about it 5 to 10 years out after the break. We'll also ask Ron and Kevin to join us after the break. Thanks for your input. It's been great so far. After the break, we'll invite Ron Shevlin, Kevin Travis, and Jerry Canning back to talk about where's this going to take us? What's it going to be like in 10 years' time? We'll be back after the break.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. In sales, are you a lion or a vulture? Lions don't wait, they just go for it. Vultures hang around until the lions are finished and just pick up the scraps. How can you set yourself apart as a lion? Join the other aspiring sales lions and listen to Forget Patience, Let's Sell Something with host Ty Maynard. You'll learn the tips and strategies of top sales professionals. You'll gain more clients at a faster rate and at higher margins. If you're a sales professional, business owner, or executive, listen in every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific on the Voice America Business Channel. Calling all CFOs, finance, and risk professionals. Your call to action is to help your company achieve financial excellence. How? Master risk management, cost control, and strategic decision-making by implementing game-changing technology advances like mobile, in-memory, and cloud computing, and more. Where? Learn from top thought leaders each week on Financial Excellence with Game Changers, presented by SAP. Join us for Financial Excellence with Game Changers, presented by SAP, Tuesday mornings at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, 12 noon Eastern Time on the Business Channel.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
You're back with Breaking Banks. I'm your host, Brett King. So if you've listened to the show before, you'll know that we always finish up the show talking about what's going to happen in the future, the next 5 to 10 years. So we've got this great audience joining us today from all over the world. Lots of great questions. I've tried to incorporate that in, but always like to finish this off. So, Ron, let me first of all bring you back and throw this question at you. Please describe for us how you think, based on these shifts and changes that we're seeing, what is banking, particularly retail banking, some extent commercial, but what's retail banking going to look like in 5 to 10 years' time as a result of smartphones, there's contextualization, there's behavioral shift in terms of the way we're buying, distributed advice? You know, what's it going to be like?
I think fundamentally, Brett, what you're really looking at is a change in the basis of competition in the industry. Years ago, it used to be competing on the basis of branch location. Then it shifted to competing on the basis of rates and fees. And now the shift is occurring again, and it's competing on the basis of performance. Who helps you perform best in terms of executing and managing your financial life? And I think one of the things that will underlie that shift is a shift from thinking about who the primary financial institution is, and many consumers today typically list a bank or a credit union as their primary FI, to a shift of thinking about what are the primary financial apps that I use. And those apps could come from anybody. And I don't think it's going to be one single app or one single digital wallet. So the focus becomes a shift from, you know, especially on the card providers who are always worried about being the top of wallet card. Now it's more of a competing to be top of phone app. And this is where the banks and financial institutions still have not lost the game, despite what a lot of the pundits say. Just quickly, if I can, share with you some of the research I've got right in front of me. Please. When we ask consumers about the relevance of offers and the quality of payment advice, banks and credit unions score very high. And no offense to Jerry, but the banks score a whole lot higher on relevance of offers and quality of advice and overall experience than Google and Apple and Facebook do. So the banks have not lost this game by any stretch of the imagination, but it's really going to be a shift from, you know, thinking about being the primary FI to providing the primary apps.
Right. So, you know, they will have to learn to adapt to giving advice contextually in real time. And presumably, to do that, they're going to have to interface with other organizations who are better at the distribution game. Do you think that's fair to say, Ron?
Yeah, and in fact, it's a way of, for them to expand their revenue opportunities. They're not just making their money directly from the consumer anymore, but making their money by linking merchants and retailers, excuse me, to the consumers who are best suited for them, and that's a way to help diversify the revenue stream.
Great, thanks for joining us, Kevin, from Novanas. So, Kevin, tell us, what do you think it's going to look like in 10 years' time? Based on extrapolating your research and what we've been talking about today, what's it look like in 10 years' time in the banking space?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that what we're seeing is a big shift from being a supply-driven physical business to being a branded marketing-driven business. And fundamentally, the question of whether banks can win or lose that battle is going to be largely down to the level of experience that they can deliver and whether they can keep up with the technological advancements of their peers in other parts of the FI industry. So I would say that you're going to end up with an industry where you've got two or three mega banks that have strong, strong brands, a lot fewer branches, maybe even as few, maybe half as many, a lot more remote transaction capabilities with extremely strong online and mobile capabilities. I think you're also going to see the rise of niche providers who may or may not have physical capabilities, but who are providing very bespoke, targeted, branded experiences that are bank-like, that may or may not be a traditional bank, where a traditional bank, like a B of A, might provide an engine or a payments capability, but where the actual customer belongs to a branded marketing company that sits on the front end. And I think that over time, that's okay, but what it means for the consumer, that's actually going to be better, because it means that they can opt into the type of services and type of fee structures they want. But at the same time, for the banking industry, it likely means we need a lot fewer, not only branches, but a lot fewer banks. And I think the big challenge for the next 10 years is, how are the regulators and everyone else going to let that transition happen? This is not the airline industry or any other traditional industry where there's bankruptcy laws, there's, you know, the regulatory infrastructure is so direct and so immediate and so present that it is not clear that the regulatory infrastructure, the technology, and the banks themselves are all on the same page. I think we're going to spend a lot of time and a lot of confusion working that out.
No, I agree. And in some respect now, with the technology moving so fast, the regulators are having to play catch up. That's
absolutely
okay, because their job is not innovators. They're there to protect the market. So
that's right.
To some extent, that's okay. But banks who sit there waiting for regulators to say what they can and can't do are going to face some difficulties with this. So, Kevin, thank you very much for joining us this week. If we don't get the chance to talk to you again, we hope to have you on another show at a later date. And Jerry from the Google team, Jerry, tell us, you know, what's it going to look like in 10 years from a Google perspective in terms of the world of banking, and where's Google going to fit in this?
Brett, earlier you referred to frictionless engagement, and that really is what's driving. That's what consumers are demanding, and that's where banks are also, when they're playing their cards right, they're seeing value. I saw a note recently where PNC is saving over $3 with every mobile check deposit that they record, as opposed to having to cover it through their retail locations. And picking up, this will drive adoption of the niche providers. And I believe peer-to-peer is something we didn't get into today, but will continue to grow across the lending space where we've seen traction and across different financial service offerings. And then technology is going to continue to drive it. One last note, I saw one of the mobile phone providers yesterday was speaking about authentication and different tests that they are looking to bring to market. And they talked about, this was Motorola yesterday, talked about everything from electronic tattoos to swallowable pills that the phone recognizes and authenticates. So I know the regulators would have a ball with that one, but these are the sort of technologies that are very real and will continue to be drive and raise the expectation bar from consumers, and the banks are going to have to consider playing in.
Absolutely, and particularly when we get into this whole issue of identity and biometrics and how to identify someone in the banking system. Right now, this is a pretty much a broken system. This process of these data points that we collect on an application form, it's just no longer robust enough to cope with this dynamic digital environment. So it'll be very, very interesting to see how that role of identity really changes these interactions and levels the playing field from a branch perspective with digital. I think that's going to be definitely part of it. So Jerry, Kevin, Ron, thank you guys for joining the show this week. I'd love to have you guys back on as we get some further research and further behavioral information that we can throw into the mix. Thanks again.
Thanks, Brett.
So, guys, just in the last minute, I just want to tell you a little bit about what we're going to be having on next week's show. We have a couple of really, really interesting guests. We're going to be talking the abstraction of money. And, of course, in the news of recent times has been Bitcoin. There's been a lot of discussion about that. This week, of course, there was a discussion a lot of discussion around Liberty Reserve, I think based in Costa Rica, if I'm not wrong. This sort of peer-to-peer PayPal for criminals that's being characterized. And, of course, there's been a lot of discussion about the anonymity of the anonymity of Bitcoin and whether this contributes to money laundering. So next week, we're going to have David Woolman, the author of The End of Money. David's going to join us along with Mark Hochstein from American Banker, who's an expert on the Bitcoin phenomenon. And we're going to be talking how this changing behavior and technology is abstracting money. When are we going to see the end of physical cash? That's next week on Breaking Banks. Thank you for joining us this week. And thanks to our guests, Ron Shevlin from ITE, Kevin Travis from Novantas, and Jerry Canning from Google Finance.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. We'll explore more changes and challenges next week.